Ailes' success is about sales. Your book is a commercial hit. Everybody's reading it. Everybody's talking about it. You're on TV. You sell hundreds, then thousands, then millions of copies. Your book becomes an it book. A catchphrase. Dump trucks beep while backing into your garage to pour endless royalty payments. Then there's social success. That means you're a success amongst your peers. People you respect. This is also known as critical success. The industry loves you. The New York Times reviews your book. You're shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. An influential author you look up to sends you a letter which feels like gold. And finally, there's self-success. It's in your head. It's invisible. Only you know if you have it. Self-success means you achieved what you wanted to achieve for yourself. You're genuinely proud of your accomplishment. You're happy with your work. And most important, you're satisfied. You want nothing. You feel contentment. Some people believe without self-success, no amount of sales success or social success will ever feel meaningful. The three S's of success apply to all industries, professions, and aspects of life. Success is not one-dimensional. You must decide what kind of success you want. Are you in marketing? Sales success means your product flew off the shelves, sales shot through the roof, and your numbers blew away forecasts. Social success means you were written up in prestigious magazines, nominated for an award, recognized by the CEO at a company meeting. Self-success? That's the same. How do you feel about your accomplishments? Are you a teacher? Sales success means you're offered promotions, asked if you're interested in becoming vice principal or principal one day. Social success means you're presenting at conferences, mentoring new teachers, and the principal talks about your work. Self-success? That's the same. How do you feel about your accomplishments? Here's the catch. It is impossible to have all three successes. I say this because I've never seen it, and I don't think you should aspire toward it, at least at first. If you have one type of success for a very long time, and then you add another for a very long time, then sure, go ahead, try for the third. But often, two corners of the success triangle actually prevent the third. How so? Well, sales success can block self-success. That's what happened when I got hooked on blog counters and bestseller lists. My personal goals suddenly took a back seat to more tangible commercial goals. Think of Krusty the Clown brand cough syrup, home pregnancy tests, and imitation gruel. 9 out of 10 orphans can't tell the difference. This is the artist who sells out. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but you can see how commercial success blocks personal success sometimes. And self-success doesn't necessarily have a marketable strategy, so no sales or social success follows. The birthday cakes you bake for your daughter, that incredible lesson you put your heart into for weeks, the backyard deck you built with your bare hands, you wouldn't expect royalty payments or critical reviews from those endeavors. You're not trying to sell cakes, lessons, or decks. You could, but that wasn't your goal. Lastly, critical darlings rarely sell. Social success can block sales success. Let me give you an example. One of my favorite movies a few years ago was The Hurt Locker. Tense, dramatic, I was glued to the screen. The movie won Best Picture at the Academy Awards. There is no higher honor. But its total domestic box office was $17 million. Alvin and the Chipmunks, the Squeakquel, came out the same year, and it ended up making $219 million. Which would you have rather made? Know which of the three S's of success you want. Chapter 6. The sad and unfortunate reason we listen to critics in the first place. We know we shouldn't listen to our critics. We know we should do things for ourselves. Morihei Ueshiba, founder of the Japanese martial art Aikido, said, "As soon as you concern yourself with the good and bad of your fellows, you create an opening in your heart for maliciousness to enter. Testing, competing with, and criticizing others weaken and defeat you. So why do we listen? What makes us interested in external measurements? Why do we take outside rankings, results, or opinions over our own opinion of ourselves? There is a root issue, an underlying reason. There is one issue that many of us have, that I know I have, that is at the basis of why we jump at external rankings. The root issue is our lack of self-confidence, self-judgment. We get lost in our own heads. We get confused with mixed advice. So we follow what we see. The root issue is self-confidence, and we're going to solve this root issue together in less than 10 minutes. I looked at him and he said, "Every single day I come to work, I feel like I'm a failure." Twilight shone through the glass window and dim lights lit up leather chairs and the shiny lacquered desk as I sat staring in disbelief at my Harvard Business School leadership professor as he smiled wryly through wet, shiny eyes. Tenured Harvard Business School professors have bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, and PhDs, and they finish at the top of their class in all three. They make six-figure salaries and consult and speak on the side to earn even more. And they're teaching at Harvard, a not-too-shabby resume bullet point. So why did my Harvard professor consider himself a failure? Well, he said, "I walk up to my office door every morning and I see that the professor in the office to my left has a Nobel Prize. And I know I'll never have a Nobel Prize." Then he said, "And I see that the professor in the office to my right has written 12 books. And I know I'll never write 12 books. I haven't even written one." Every single morning I'm reminded how inferior I am, and it kills me. I looked at him and could tell he was smiling and trying to make a point, but I could also see there was some truth in his words. After all, in his world, all his major accomplishments are neutralized by his peers. Piles of degrees, million-dollar bank accounts, prestigious jobs, all just par for the course. Chapter 7: The Secret Scribble to Increasing Your Confidence. What is confidence? Time for our next scribble. Now I'm drawing a box divided into four quadrants, commonly called a 2x2 matrix. Along the vertical axis, I'm writing opinion of others. And at the bottom it says low. At the top, it says high. Along the horizontal axis, I'm writing opinion of self. On the left side, I'm writing low. On the right side, I'm writing high. What I'm saying is, we can have a low or high opinion of others. We can have a low or high opinion of ourselves. Let's talk about your opinion of yourself. It can be high or low. Sure, it will flip-flop all the time. But let's say in any instant, it can be high or it can be low. Does confidence just have to do with your opinion of yourself? No. Most people think it does, but we always have an opinion of others too. What do you call people with a high opinion of themselves and a low opinion of others? They're not confident. They are arrogant. I've just written arrogant in the lower right quadrant of the scribble. Stuck up. Egotistical. Big-headed. Arrogant people are not confident because they don't understand that having a high opinion of others doesn't lower their opinion of themselves. They are affected by other people's confidence. It makes them feel weak. So they try to lower that confidence while increasing their own. Remember the schoolyard bully who actually feels bad about himself deep down? This is the guy we're talking about here. This is the guy who feels the need to be better than others in order to be good at all. That's why we labeled it arrogant. Next box. What do you call people with a high opinion of others but a low opinion of themselves? The word to describe those people is insecure. I've now written the word insecure in the top left quadrant of the box. So right now we have arrogant in the bottom right quadrant, and we have insecure in the top left quadrant. We've all been there too. We think greatly of other people and believe ourselves to be lesser than. You feel this way when you stare at a group photo and say something like, "Oh my God, I look hideous. I look huge. You look great, though." Talk about beating yourself up. High opinion of others, low opinion of yourself. So we have two empty boxes left on this quadrant. Now, what do you call people with a low opinion of themselves and a low opinion of others? No high opinions of anyone at all. The word to describe them is cynical. And I have just written cynical on the lower left-hand quadrant. We now have arrogant in the bottom right, insecure in the top left, and cynical in the bottom left. We've all been there too. Low opinion of others, low opinion of ourselves. You know, bad days, bad bosses, big mistakes. We can get into a funk and see problems everywhere. We become cynical. The cynic isn't confident. Cynical is the furthest thing from confident. As Conan O'Brien said on his final episode hosting The Tonight Show, "All I ask of you is one thing. Please don't be cynical. I hate cynicism. It's my least favorite quality and it doesn't lead anywhere." So now that we have three boxes filled in, what's left? What do the truly confident people have? Well, by now you've probably guessed. They have a high opinion of themselves, and they have a high opinion of others. That is the true definition of confidence. I have just written confident in the top right-hand quadrant of the box. High opinion of self, high opinion of others. Buddha says, "You can search throughout the entire universe for someone who is more deserving of your love and affection than you are yourself, and that person is not to be found anywhere. You, yourself, as much as anybody in the entire universe, deserve your love and affection." Chapter 8, Three Simple Steps to Self-Acceptance. How do we get to that dream place? How do we accept ourselves and think highly of others at the same time? How can we separate those two opinions in our mind so we can allow both? There are three steps to achieving a high opinion of yourself. It is a torturous path, but we go through this journey with every part of ourselves that we eventually learn to accept. The three steps are: 1, hide. 2, apologize. 3, accept. And here's what it looks like. Hide. For years after I graduated from Harvard, I answered the question the same way most of my classmates did. Them. "So where did you go to school anyway?" Me. "Boston." Them. "Cool." Eventually, I started realizing that masking is a form of self-judgment. I wasn't confident about having attended Harvard. I was afraid to mention Harvard because I was afraid of people's perceptions. Elite, nerdy, trust fund kids with silver spoons, shady bankers corrupting society. Whatever they were going to think, I was going to avoid. Rather than identify with this part of my identity, I hid it. I didn't mention it in my biography, in my blog, or in any of my books, in any radio lead-ins, any newspaper interviews. I didn't list my degree in my email signature at work, like most of my coworkers. I called this humility. But it was fear. After a couple years, I figured this out and decided that from then on, I would tell anybody exactly where I went to school if they asked. Of course, I did this in a tentative way, an awkward way, like dipping my toe in freezing cold water off the dock. Not really sure. How did I do it? Apologize. Them. "So, where'd you go to school anyway?" Me. Harvard? Them. I think I heard of that place." By acting awkward, I made things awkward for others. By apologizing for myself, I forced others to apologize too. Eventually, I started realizing that apologizing was a form of self-judgment too. Great, another one. Apologizing was communicating a part of myself, then immediately sounding a bright red Family Feud triple X buzzer through it. We surveyed 100 people and the top 5 answers are on the board. Name a school you attended. Harvard? Apologizing avoids ownership. Apologizing creates distance. Apologizing suggests a mistake. Apologizing is what you do when your dog craps on the neighbor's lawn, and then you look up and notice your neighbor watching from the window. Sorry! Well, eventually I realized this, and after a couple years of apologizing, I finally moved on to the third and final step. Accept. Them. So where did you go to school anyway? Me. Harvard. Them. Cool. Gone went the tendency to hide the truth from others, which reflected my desire to hide it from myself. Gone went the tentativeness and questioning, which reflected my tentativeness and questioning part of myself. Replacing both came a clear and simple truth. Replacing both came a solid, grounded fact. By being clear and simple, without pretension, without assumptions, I consciously remove myself from any possible judgment that comes from any given statement. This allows whatever judgment that comes to be wholly owned by the other person. Physicist Richard Feynman says, "You have no responsibility to live up to what other people think you ought to accomplish. I have no responsibility to be like they expect me to be. It's their mistake, not my failing." Accepting yourself communicates confidence. Accepting yourself insulates you from the washing machine of emotions that comes from other people's views swaying your own, swishing your thoughts, bending your beliefs, until they're muddy in even your own head. What do you do with their views? How do you stop judging yourself? You laugh at it. A big laugh, H-A-A-ha, helps you look deep, notice your self-judgments, and push through the steps to accepting part of yourself. H, hide. A, apologize. A, accept. Ha. We're all full of self-judgments. We're fat, lazy, don't exercise enough, aren't worthy of a raise, aren't worthy of her love, wouldn't find another job if we were fired, wouldn't find a new boyfriend if we were dumped. Sometimes we forget that we are all trying. We are all trying. We are all trying. We are all getting better. You are what you are, what you are. Find what's hidden, stop apologizing, and accept yourself. Chapter 9. How does Buddha use this secret? One day Buddha was visiting a tiny village. He had become a religious man, also called a Brahmin, and was traveling from town to town to share his message. He was becoming so popular that when people heard the Buddha was coming, they went to hear him speak. As a result, many other Brahmins lost their audience. One Brahmin was so upset with the Buddha that he found him and went to see him late at night. He was furious. "You have no right teaching others," he shouted. "You are as stupid as everyone else. You are nothing but a fake." Buddha smiled at the Brahmin and listened until he was done with his rant. When the Brahmin was done, Buddha still sat, smiling at him. This made the Brahmin even angrier. "Why are you just sitting there smiling? What do you have to say?" Then Buddha spoke. "Tell me something, Brahmin. Do friends and colleagues, relatives and kinsmen, ever come to your house as guests?"
"Yes,"
the Brahmin answered. "And tell me something, Brahmin," Buddha continued. "Do you serve them foods and delicacies when they arrive?"
"Yes," the Brahmin answered. "I do."
"And tell me something, Brahmin," Buddha continued. "If they don't accept them, to whom do those foods belong?"
"Well, I suppose if they don't accept them, those foods are all mine."
"Yes," said Buddha. "In the same way, Brahmin, I do not accept your anger and your criticism. It is all yours." The Brahmin was stunned.
and could think of nothing to say. His anger continued to bubble up inside him, but he had nowhere to put it. Nobody was accepting it or taking it from him. Buddha continued, "That with which you have insulted me, who is not insulting? That with which you have taunted me, who is not taunting? That with which you have berated me, who is not berating? That I don't accept from you. It's all yours, Brahman. It's all yours. If you become angry with me and I do not get insulted, then the anger falls back on you. You are then the only one who becomes unhappy. All you have done is hurt yourself. If you want to stop hurting yourself, you must get rid of your anger and become loving instead. Whoever returns insult to one who is insulting, returns taunts to one who is taunting, returns a berating to one who is berating, is eating together, sharing company with that person. But I am neither eating together nor sharing your company, Brahman. It's all yours. It's all yours." Chapter 10. What does a message secretly hidden under Wimbledon Center Court show us? There are two lines of a poem above the player entrance to Center Court at Wimbledon, and they say, "If you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same." Picture walking down the tunnel under that sign on your way to play in the Wimbledon final. If you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same. Sunlight beams through the entryway, and you catch a glimpse of thousands filling the stands. The royal family is in their private box, and cameras capture your every action. Smile at your girlfriend, miss a shot and scream, sweat through your t-shirt. It's all beamed to hundreds of millions around the world. You have played tennis every single day for 15 years. You picked up an old racket as a kid, and everyone said you were a natural, so you made it your life. Your parents mortgaged their house to get you private lessons. You skipped graduation and prom because of tournaments. You managed to avoid major injuries by designing your off-court life to complement tennis. No skiing, no boozing, no building decks with your bare hands. It all led to this. Right here, right now, this is the big one. If you win this match, you walk away with $3 million. Lose, and you don't. And the $3 million doesn't include the notoriety, sponsorships, and legacy you'll create. Everybody remembers who wins Wimbledon. Nobody remembers who finishes second. Who are you up against in this game? Only the best tennis player in the entire world. Now, right before you walk onto the court, onto the biggest tennis match of your life, your eye catches the quote. If you can meet with triumph and disaster, and treat those two imposters just the same. It jolts you. You pause and digest it. No matter what happens right now, triumph or disaster, it's an imposter. You should treat them the same. Winning or losing is the same. Place the game in the context of your entire life. The world will go on. You will have more highs and more lows no matter what. If you can meet with triumph or disaster and treat those two imposters just the same, you are competing only with yourself. You relax, take a deep breath, and walk on the court smiling. Although there's no attribution on that wall, these two lines are from a poem called If, written by Rudyard Kipling in 1895. Kipling was an English short story writer and poet born in India, who went on to win the Nobel Prize in Literature and was declared England's favorite poet in national polls. If is 32 beautiful lines written by Rudyard Kipling to his son John as parental advice on how to be confident, accept yourself, and do it for you. I'm going to read the poem for you now. If by Rudyard Kipling. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you. If you can trust yourself when all men doubt you,
but make allowance for their doubting too. If you can wait and not be tired by waiting, or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good, nor talk too wise. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster, and treat those two imposters just the same. If you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to, broken, and stoop and build them up with worn-out tools. If you can make one heap of all your winnings, and risk it on one turn of pitch and toss, and lose and start again at your beginnings, and never breathe a word about your loss. If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they are gone, and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you, but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it. And, which is more, you'll be a man, my son. Remember secret number 2. What do you do so criticism can't touch you? Remember to do it for you. Chapter 11. I don't stand back and judge, I do. Do it for you. When I was young, I asked my cousin why it seemed to me that the NCAA Final Four was more exciting to watch than the NBA. I don't understand, I said. These college guys are running as fast as possible, diving for balls, jumping for difficult shots, smiling and laughing the whole time. When I flip to an NBA game, the point guard is walking up the court. Everyone is sitting on the bench instead of standing and screaming. My cousin smiled and said, "The college guys aren't getting paid for it. They might never get paid for it. They're doing it for themselves because they love it." His words rang clear as a bell. At around that same age, I used to love rolling up my parents' change so they could take it to the bank every few months. I loved sorting the coins and counting up the exact number for each roll. I loved standing the coins up on their sides while squeezing them tightly together with my fingers. I loved carefully rolling them into those slippery little papers before folding tightly at the ends. Turning a big jar of coins into a small, heavy pile was deeply satisfying. Then one day my mom said, "Neil, for your allowance, you can keep 10% of whatever you roll." What did I do? I rolled all the quarters and dimes, but quit before the nickels and pennies. I said I'd get back to those. My mom was disappointed. Suddenly, I didn't appreciate rolling 50 pennies for 5 cents when a roll of quarters earned me a dollar. Do it for you. Blog counters, score sheets, and job evaluations will always tell you how you're doing. They will deliver external rewards like money, promotions, or critical praise. But those rewards mask your intrinsic motivators. You go from running down the court to walking. You start focusing on appealing to those judging you. Risk-taking disappears. Remember, it's not the critic who counts. It's the man in the arena. Pick the type of success you're aiming for and have a high opinion of yourself and a high opinion of others along the way. Move through hiding and apologizing to eventually accepting all parts of you. And, as Buddha said, let others keep their criticism for you. Do it for you. Let's finish this secret with a story. John Lennon was one of the most fiercely independent artists of all time. Do it for you? He did. Most people who experienced his level of sales and social success would never walk away from the Beatles. But he privately told Paul, George, and Ringo in September 1969 that he was leaving the group. More than a decade later, just weeks before his death,
John Lennon was asked in a famous Playboy interview if he thought his post-Beatles music would ever have the lasting imprint of his work with the Beatles. Tough question. What did he say? I'm not judging whether I Am the Walrus is better or worse than Imagine. It is for others to judge. I am doing it. I do. I don't stand back and judge. I do. Say I do and do it for you. Secret number 3. The 3 words that will save you on your very worst days. Chapter 1. The first war you are fighting every day. We are going to get to those 3 words, but first we need to understand what's causing our very worst days. Your amygdala is in the oldest part of your brain. It is responsible for scanning the world for worries. It is a problem scanning machine. Imagine. You have a problem-scanning machine right in your own head, always on, always scanning, all day and all night. When the machine finds a problem, or even thinks it finds a problem, it flushes your body full of adrenaline and stress hormones, sending you into fight or flight mode. Daniel Goleman, best-selling author of Emotional Intelligence, says, "The emotional component evolved very early. Do I eat it, or does it eat me?" He calls this the amygdala hijack and describes it as a way our brains take control of our bodies. Remember the reason it's so hard to be happy from secret number 1. We all have negative thoughts. Those negative thoughts helped keep us safe and led to our survival through very strong emotional reactions. See a saber-toothed tiger suddenly look at you from a few hundred feet away in the grassy plains? You need your problem-scanning machine to flash. You have a problem. And this part of our brains is still part of our heads, part of our lives, even though the chances of being chased down by 2,000-pound cats is gone. This war in our heads reminds us of one major truth, though. None of us can control our emotions. We can only control our reactions to our emotions. In addition to the amygdala, our brains have also evolved a prefrontal cortex responsible for rational thought. This is a new part of our brains. This part of our brains contains our most complex thoughts. Let's call it our Serenity Now mood tape. It plays quiet music. It contemplates. It's responsible for thinking before acting. It decides what we do before we do it. The prefrontal cortex helps you think things through. It's responsible for language and your ability to solve complex problems. Sometimes you can feel the problem-scanning machine and your Serenity Now mood tape blasting full volume at the same time. Say you get asked to make a presentation to the CEO late one afternoon. Your problem-scanning machine suddenly flashes bright red lights and makes that annoying alarm clock morning buzz. Meanwhile, your Serenity Now mood tape is playing birds chirping and waves crashing onto the beach. That is your brain taking time to decide what to do, trying to think things through instead of acting on impulses. It is a war waged inside your own head. Our problem-scanning machine, amygdala, and our Serenity Now mood tape, prefrontal cortex, are at war. Chapter 2. The second war you are fighting every day. The second war is the war between more and enough. Today we live in a culture of more instead of our old culture of enough. New trend? No. Growing trend. Growing in our culture for more than 100 years. Pat Momand was one of the first to put a finger on our shift from the culture of enough to the culture of more. Pop was born in San Diego on May 15, 1887, and moved to New York City at age 21, where he got a job as a sketch artist for the New York World. After getting married, Pop had a bit of success under his belt, so he and his wife moved to Cedarhurst, New York, a suburb on Long Island with big homes and moneymakers. Though the Momands had a high quality of life, Pop and his wife found themselves in a constant race to have an even higher quality of life than their wealthier neighbors. It drained them. So they quit the fancy lifestyle, moved back to Manhattan, and got an apartment in a poor part of town. Then Pop created a comic strip based on his experience in the ritzy suburbs and pitched it to his bosses. The comic strip he created was called Keeping Up with the Joneses. He originally called it Keeping Up with the Smiths, but changed it because Joneses sounded better. Pop told the story of the fictional McGinnises, whose obsession with high society dominates their lives. The Joneses are a couple the reader never sees, a comic book pokeroo, but they wave a commanding wand over the McGinnises' lives. Punchy, acerbic, reflecting society's growing obsession with relative wealth, the strip took off, getting syndicated and picked up in hundreds of newspapers and eventually running for 28 years. It was even turned into a book, a movie, and a musical. Meg Jacobs writes in Technology and Culture about the growth of the culture of more between 1890 and 1930. As new technologies enabled mass production and mass distribution, Americans no longer had to just be content with what they had. They could act on their desires. No longer a sin, envy was now a staple of the new consumer economy. Americans no longer had to just be content with what they had. They could act on their desires. After World War I, there were new mass production techniques that enabled mass marketing of products like washing machines, stoves, and canned goods that advertised convenience. Who didn't want one? And along came installment plans for buying large items like houses. Suddenly we had radios to beam advertisements right into our houses. Buying things was driving the economy. Paul Mazur of Lehman Brothers wrote in a 1927 issue of Harvard Business Review, "We must shift America from a needs to a desires culture. People must be trained to desire, to want new things, even before the old have been entirely consumed. We must shape a new mentality in America. Man's desires must overshadow his needs." More, more, we all want more. We have grown up in a world where more has always meant better. But that's baloney. More than 100 years later, and we are still keeping up with the Joneses. A couple years ago, I asked my boss, Casey, how his young kids were doing as I was packing up my notes and leaving his office on a late Friday afternoon before the weekend. He was head of the department and had the only office at the company with abstract paintings on the walls and leather chairs beside his desk. "Good, good, thanks," he said. "They're excited to show me an app tonight which they built at school." "Oh, that's cool," I looked up. "Do they have their own laptops?" "Yeah," he smiled at me, looking a bit guilty. He saw my quiet smile back and continued. "Look, my kids are lucky. You and I both know that. But they don't. Their world is different. We live in a big house. They go to private schools. They have their own computers. But their friends at school go to Europe for long weekends, and we don't do that. And one has an indoor basketball court in his house. My son came home from school yesterday and asked me why we didn't have a basketball court inside our house. The culture of more affects us all. So what do we do?" Chapter 3. The One Thing Many Billionaires Want But Cannot Have. Your problem scanning machine spends its day looking for worries. It's helpful when you're in serious trouble, but stressful when you're not. On top of that, we're living in a culture of more versus a culture of enough. Everywhere we look, we are reminded of what else we need. You can move to a shack in the woods to get away from it all, but we'd miss you too much there. Please don't do that. Bottom line, it's tough playing defense against those wars. So where do you start? First, you need to remember the one thing most billionaires want, but cannot have. Kurt Vonnegut and Joseph Heller are two of the most famous authors of the 20th century, writers of classics that have sold millions, including Slaughterhouse-Five and Catch-22. They were friends. And here's a story Kurt Vonnegut wrote in The New Yorker after Joseph Heller passed away. He wrote, "True story, word of honor. Joseph Heller, an important and funny writer, now dead, and I were at a party given by a billionaire on Shelter Island. I said, 'Joe, how does it make you feel to know that our host only yesterday may have made more money than your novel Catch-22 has earned in its entire history?' And Joe said, 'I've got something he can never have.' And I said, 'What on earth could that be, Joe?' And Joe said, 'The knowledge that I've got enough.' Not bad. Rest in peace." Chapter 4. What does a Greek philosopher have in common with the Rolling Stones? Greek philosopher Epictetus says, "Wealth consists not in having great possessions, but in having few wants. A famous Persian proverb hung on my aunt's kitchen wall reads, "I cried because I had no shoes until I met a man who had no feet." And the Rolling Stones famously sing, "You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, you just might find you get what you need." Chapter 5. When does making $1 million feel like nothing? Thinking about the trouble we get into when we fall into the culture of more reminds me of a dinner conversation I had with my friend Josh Tannehill. Josh was asked by his company to move from CEO to an advisory role, which meant he was going from making $2 million a year to half of that. Still a great job, just a lower level position than he had before. Less responsibilities, less than what he wanted. I asked Josh over dinner how he was feeling about the new job. "I'll be honest," he said. "I'm worried about making ends meet. Donna's running a design store that loses money, but gives her so much joy. We're halfway through building our retirement home north of San Francisco, and the invoices just keep getting bigger. Plus, there's our place on Martha's Vineyard. Our whole family meets there for 4th of July and Thanksgiving. With the amount of moving we've done for work, it's become our home. But the boats, taxes, and maintenance are too much. With 2 kids in grad school and our oldest needing financial support, I honestly don't know what to do." I felt sorry for Josh. He was in pain. He was an unfortunate example of what the culture of more can do. What's the solution? It's time for the 3 words. Word number 1, remember. Word number 2, the. Word number 3, lottery. Remember the lottery. What does that mean? It means be conscious of your problem scanning machine's amygdala hijack. Be conscious of the more you want. And be conscious to remember how lucky you are to be where you are. Remember you have enough. Remember more isn't always better. Remember the lottery. Chapter 6. The classic tale of the Mexican fisherman. A boat is docked in a tiny fisherman's village. A tourist wearing expensive sunglasses and a fancy watch walks by and compliments a fisherman on the quality of his fish and asks how long it took him to catch them. "Not very long," answers the fisherman. "But then, why didn't you stay out longer and catch more?" asks the tourist. The fisherman explains his small catch is enough to meet his needs and the needs of his family. The tourist asks, "But what do you do with the rest of your time?" "I sleep late, fish a little, play with my children, and take a siesta with my wife," he says. "In the evenings, I go into the village to see my friends, have a few drinks, play the guitar, and sing a few songs. I have a full life." The tourist jumps in. "I have an MBA and I can help you. You should start by fishing longer every day. You can then sell the extra fish you catch. With the extra money, you can buy a bigger boat." "And after that?" asks the fisherman. "With the extra money the larger boat will bring, you can buy a second one and a third one and so on until you have an entire fleet of trawlers. Instead of selling your fish to a middleman, you can then negotiate directly with the processing plants and maybe even open your own plant. You can then leave this little village and move to New York City. From there, you can direct your huge new enterprise." "How long would that take?" asks the fisherman. 20 or 25 years at most," replies the tourist. "And after that?" "After that? Well, my friend, that's when it gets really interesting," answers the tourist, laughing. "When your business gets really big, you can sell your company stock to the public and make millions." "Millions? Really? And after that?" asks the fisherman. "After that, you'll be able to retire, live in a tiny village near the coast, sleep late, play with your children, catch a few fish, take a siesta with your wife, and spend your evenings drinking and playing guitar with your friends." Chapter 7. How to use the 3 words on your very worst days. The Mexican fisherman already had enough. He didn't need to remember the lottery. He knew he'd already won. You and I aren't so lucky. I used to feel stressed several times a week when the car in front of me didn't move on a green, when I dropped and shattered a glass on the kitchen floor, when I had a deadline coming up next week. I felt like my life was on the line. I felt frustrated if everything wasn't going right. What did I do? Remember the lottery. In these moments, I moved my head to a zoomed out state. When I was a kid, I lay in bed picturing my body slowly floating up and up and up over my bed and my room and my house. Then I'd picture floating even higher above the neighborhood and the city and the clouds into low orbit outer space. I would gaze down at the distant flickering lights of my hometown, and I'd imagine my problems way down there, and nothing felt as serious. Remember the lottery. So let's try this together. How small does Earth look next to Uranus and Neptune and Saturn and Jupiter? Well, if we are a golf ball, they are tennis balls and bowling balls. And how big is the sun compared to our golf ball? It's larger than a house. And as we keep zooming out, there are hundreds of thousands of stars, just like our sun, filling up our Milky Way galaxy. What's a galaxy? A clump of stars, gas, and dust held together by gravity. We live in one, and scientists estimate there are 600,000 stars in our galaxy alone. Yes, our sun is just one of 600,000 stars in our galaxy. We are all spinning out here. But it goes much farther. How much farther? Well, have you ever seen the Hubble Space Telescope? Basically, it's the world's biggest camera. It was invented to take pictures of outer space from outer space. We blasted it off more than 20 years ago, pointed it into the deepest, darkest corner of the universe, and opened the shutter for a few months. Then we closed the shutter, pulled the camera back to Earth, got the picture developed, and guess what came back? What came back is something that's really hard for me to describe to you, but I think it's the most beautiful photo ever taken. Picture a big black square. And as you peek into the distance of the image, there are hundreds of thousands of other galaxies. Swirling milky circles, big, long, deep, brightly lit tunnels, each of them representing hundreds of thousands of stars. The universe goes so deep. The universe goes so far. And the most amazing thing of all is nowhere else in the entire deep, distant universe is there any other place our species exists. Nowhere else can we breathe air, drink water, eat plants. Nowhere else can we find people to meet, fall in love, and make babies. We live on the only place that can possibly support life. Carl Sagan said, "It has been said that astronomy is a humbling and character-building experience. There is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish the pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known." We live on the pale blue dot, and it's a beautiful dot. So on this planet, on the only planet in the universe where we can live, we get to be alive. You have to remember that most people who have ever lived on Earth are dead. There are about 7 billion people on Earth today, and 115 billion people who have ever lived in the history of the world. That means 108 billion people are dead. Most people have already lived their lives. Think of it this way. 14 out of every 15 people who have ever lived will never see another sunset again, have a bowl of chocolate ice cream, or kiss their kids goodnight. 14 out of every 15 people will never stroll by the smell of their neighbor barbecuing, flip to the cold side of the pillow before sleeping in on a Sunday, or blow out the flickering candles of a birthday cake in a dark kitchen surrounded by their closest friends. Being alive means you already won the lottery. You are among the wealthiest people in the entire world. The average world income is $5,000. Are you higher than that? Then you're in the top 50%. And if you're higher than $50,000, you're in the top 0.5%. Do you need much more than 99.5% of people alive? You either have the money to buy this book or you have the time to listen to it. Either way, you have it good. You already have more than almost everybody on the planet. On your very worst days, you have to push your negative thoughts. You have to take a step back. You have to remember the lottery and remember you've already won. And that's the end of section one, want nothing. We talked about three secrets. Secret number one, be happy first. Secret number two, do it for you. And secret number three, remember the lottery. Section two, do anything. According to a palliative nurse, the number one regret of the dying, as reported in The Guardian, is, I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. Steve Jobs said, remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart. And Jay-Z said, remind yourself, nobody built like you. You design yourself. Secret number four, the dream we all have that is completely wrong. Chapter one, the terrible tragedy of Mr. Wilson. He's dead. Staring in shock at my high school guidance department secretary, I thought that it couldn't be true. I just talked to him last week. It happened so suddenly, she whispered, tears shining through thick glasses, glossy red lips quivering silently in slow motion. I am so sorry. Mr. Wilson was my guidance counselor. He had a shiny head holding two fluffy cloud patches of gray hair on the sides and wore thick glasses and loose-fitting gray t-shirts while helping students with timetables, college applications, and personal problems. Everybody loved Mr. Wilson. I talked to him about summer jobs, and he calmed me down during exams. He had a quiet, big-picture worldview that helped us get above ourselves and see beyond life in our hometown. You could tell Mr. Wilson loved his job by the way his eyes twinkled as he bounced through the halls, spouting hellos and high-fiving students, calling everybody by name. He was always smiling, and our school was his home. Back when I was in high school, the government had mandatory retirement. You turned 65, and poof! The government yanked you out of the workforce in a cloud of smoke and moved you straight onto old age pension. You had no choice. And let's face it, almost everybody wanted to retire way before 65 anyway. TV ads preached Freedom 55, with gray-haired couples skipping town to swim at the cottage, play golf, and sail into the sunset. Retirement is a good thing, a great thing, what everybody wants, dreams about, wishes for, over and over and over and over until it finally comes. Do whatever, whenever, wherever, forever? Sounds like a good deal. The funny thing is that when Mr. Wilson retired, he didn't look happy. None of us did. We had the big celebration with cake, music from the band, and teary speeches from former students. It was like the final scene in Mr. Holland's opus. Mr. Wilson said he was excited to be retiring, but his thin smile and wet eyes said the exact opposite. But mandatory retirement came at age 65, and so he retired. The next week he had a heart attack and died. Chapter 2. Thomas Jefferson and Teddy Roosevelt agree on this. Thomas Jefferson said, determined never to be idle. No person will have occasion to complain of the want of time who never loses any. Teddy Roosevelt said, the best prize that life has to offer is the chance to work hard at work worth doing. And former Esquire editor Martha Sherrill said, I often think about dogs when I think about work and retirement. There are many breeds of dog that just need to be working and useful or have a job of some kind in order to be happy. Otherwise, they are neurotically barking, scratching, or tearing up the sofa. A working dog needs to work, and I am a working dog. So what kind of dog are you? If you like thinking, if you like trying, if you like creating, if you like teaching, if you like learning, if you like connecting, then chances are good you're a working dog too. And what do working dogs do? They work. They never give up. They never stop doing. They never retire. If you like neurotically barking, scratching, and tearing up the sofa, let's chat. Because the truth is, you always need to do something. Something different, something interesting, something you love. But let me tell you another secret. You need an icky guy first. Chapter 3. What can the healthiest 100-year-olds in the world teach us? Men and women in Okinawa live an average of 7 years longer than Americans and have the longest disability-free life expectancy on Earth. Ancient Chinese legends call these sandy islands popping out of the sparkling blue East China Sea the land of immortals. This is where a 96-year-old defeated a former boxing champ in his 30s. This is where a 105-year-old killed a poisonous snake with a fly swatter. There are more people over 100 years old in Okinawa than anywhere else. Researchers from National Geographic were so fascinated by Okinawans that they studied what helped them live so long. What did they find out? They eat off smaller plates. They stop eating when they're 80% full. And they have a beautiful setup where they're put into social groups as babies to slowly grow old together. But they also have an outlook on life that is very different from ours in the West. While we think of retirement as the golden age of putting greens, cottage docks, and staring at the clouds, guess what they call retirement in Okinawa? They don't. They don't even have a word for retirement. Literally nothing in their language describes the concept of stopping work completely. Instead, they have the word ikigai, spelled I-K-I-G-A-I, which roughly means the reason you wake up in the morning. You can think of it as the thing that drives you most. In Okinawa, there is a 102-year-old karate master whose ikigai is to carry forth his martial art. A 100-year-old fisherman whose ikigai is to feed his family. A 102-year-old woman whose ikigai is to hold her great-great-great-granddaughter. Sound bunk? Well, Toshisama Sone and his colleagues at the Tohoku University Graduate School of Medicine thought it might be, so they put the ikigai concept to a test. They spent 7 years in Sendai, Japan, studying the longevity of more than 43,000 Japanese adults, looking at age, gender, education, body mass index, cigarette use, alcohol consumption, exercise, employment, perceived stress, history of disease, and even the subject's self-rated scores of how healthy they were. Then they asked every single one of these 43,000 people a question. They said, do you have an ikigai in your life? Can you guess what they found out? Participants reporting an ikigai at the beginning of the study were more likely to be married, educated, and employed. They had higher levels of self-rated health and lower levels of stress. What about at the end of the 7-year study? Well, 95% of folks with an ikigai were alive. Only 83% of those without an ikigai made it that long. So guess what I gave Leslie for Christmas last year? An ikigai card. I made 2 cards out of construction paper, folded them up, and put one on each of our bedside tables. They cost me about 10 cents. We each wrote down our ikigai and left the cards on our bedsides. She wrote, to turn young minds into future leaders. And I wrote, to remind myself and others how lucky we are to be alive. We leave the cards on our nightstand so we're reminded of them first thing in the morning. We change what they say sometimes. I change my ikigai to finish writing the happiness equation for a while. Why do we have these ikigais? They are a reason to get up in the morning. With an ikigai card, when you wake up, you know where you're going. Chapter 4. The single greatest lesson we can learn from Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. The ikigai idea of having a purpose reminds me of my favorite quote from Lewis Carroll's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. One day, Alice came to a fork in the road and saw a Cheshire Cat in a tree. "Which road do I take?" she asked. "Where do you want to go?" was his response. "I don't know," Alice answered. "Then," said the cat, "it doesn't matter." Chapter 5. The horrible idea the Germans had that ruined things for everybody. Where did retirement even come from? No purpose, no ikigai. It doesn't matter which way you go if you don't know where you're going. Sure, we all have bad days at work. Bosses agitate, coworkers frustrate, but work gives us purpose, belonging, and direction.